Do you think a president should keep secrets from the people she or he governs? No, but there have to be some things that we can't know, for national security alone. He smiled, happy, it seemed, that she'd said what he expected her to say. Really, May? Do you recall when a man named Julian Assange leaked several million pages of secret U.S. documents? I read about it. Well, first of all, the U.S. government was very upset, as was much of the media. Many people thought this was a serious breach of security and that it presented a clear and present danger to our men and women in uniform here and abroad. But do you remember if any soldiers ever actually were harmed by these documents being released? I don't know. None were. Not a one. Same thing happened in the 70s with the Pentagon Papers. Not one soldier got even a splinter due to the release of these documents. The main effect, I remember, of these documents being made public is that we found out that many of our diplomats are gossipy about the leaders of other countries. Millions of documents. And the main takeaway was that U.S. diplomats thought Gaddafi was a kook, with all his female bodyguards and strange eating habits. If anything, the release of the documents just put these diplomats on better behavior. They were more careful about what they said. But national defense, what about it? The only time we're in danger is when we don't know the plans or motives of the countries we're supposedly at odds with, or when they don't know our plans, but worry about them, right? Sure. But what if they did know our plans, and we knew theirs? You'd suddenly be free of what they used to call the risk of mutually assured destruction, and instead, you'd arrive at mutually assured trust. The U.S. has no purely nefarious motives, right? We're not planning to wipe some country off the map. Sometimes, though, we take surreptitious steps to get what we want. But what if everyone was, and had to be, open and up front? It would be better? Bailey smiled broadly. Good. I agree. He put his cup down and again rested his hands in his lap. May knew she shouldn't press him, but her mouth got ahead of her. But you can't be saying that everyone should know everything. Bailey's eyes widened, as if pleased she'd led him to an idea he coveted. Of course not. But I am saying that everyone should have a right to know everything, and should have the tools to know everything. There's not enough time to know everything, though I certainly wish there was. He paused, lost briefly in thought, then returned his focus to May. I understand you weren't very happy about being the subject of Gus's love-love demonstration. It just caught me by surprise. He hadn't told me about it beforehand. Is that all? Well, it presented a distorted impression of me. Was the information he presented incorrect? There were factual mistakes? Well, it wasn't that. It was just piecemeal. And maybe that made it seem incorrect. It was taking a few slivers of me and presenting that as the whole me. It seemed incomplete. Right. May, I'm very glad you put it that way. As you know, the circle is itself trying to become complete. We're trying to close the circle at the circle. He smiled at his own wordplay. But you know the overall goals of completion, I assume. She didn't. I think so, she said. Look at our logo, he said, and pointed to a wall screen where, on his cue, the logo appeared. See how that C in the middle is open? For years it's bothered me, and it's become symbolic of what's left to do here, which is to close it. The C on the screen closed and became a perfect circle. See that? He said. A circle is the strongest shape in the universe. Nothing can beat it. Nothing can improve upon it. Nothing can be more perfect. And that's what we want to be. Perfect. So any information that eludes us, anything that's not accessible, prevents us from being perfect. You see? I do, May said, though she wasn't sure she did. This is in line with our goals for how the circle can help us, individually, feel more complete, and feel that others' impressions of us are complete, are based on complete information, and to prevent us from feeling, as you did, that some distorted view of ourselves is presented to the world. It's like a broken mirror. If we look into a broken mirror, a mirror that's cracked or missing parts, what do we get? Now it made sense to me. Any assessment, judgment, or picture utilizing incomplete information would always be wrong. We get a distorted and broken reflection, she said.
Right,
Bailey said. And if the mirror is whole? We see everything. A mirror is truthful, correct? Of course, it's a mirror, it's reality. But a mirror can only be truthful when it's complete. And I think for you, the problem with Gus's love-love presentation was that it wasn't complete.
Okay.
Okay?
Well, that's true, she said.
She wasn't sure why she opened her mouth, but the words tumbled out before she could restrain them. But I still think there are things, even if just a few, that we want to keep to ourselves. I mean, everyone does things alone or in the bedroom that they're ashamed of.
But why should they be ashamed?
Maybe not always ashamed, but things they don't want to share, that maybe they don't think people will understand or will change the perception of them.
Okay. With that kind of thing, one of two things will eventually happen. First, we'll realize that whatever behavior we're talking about is so widespread and harmless that it needn't be secret. If we demystify it, if we admit that it's something we all do, then it loses its power to shock. We move toward honesty, and we move away from shame. Or second, and even better, if we all, as a society, decide that this is behavior we'd rather not engage in, the fact that everyone knows or has the power to know who's doing it, this would prevent the behavior from being engaged in. This is just as you said. You wouldn't have stolen if you knew you were being watched.
Right.
Would the guy down the hall view porn at work if he knew he was being watched?
No, I guess not.
So problem solved, right?
Right, I guess.
May, have you ever had a secret that festered within you and once that secret was out, you felt better?
Sure.
Me too. That's the nature of secrets. They're cancerous when kept within us, but harmless when they're out in the world.
So you're saying there should be no secrets?
I have thought on this for years, and I have yet to conjure a scenario where a secret does more good than harm. Secrets are the enablers of antisocial, immoral, and destructive behavior. Do you see how this is?
I think so, but...
You know what my spouse said to me years ago when we got married? She said that whenever we were apart, for instance, when I might go on a business trip, I should behave as if there were a camera on me, as if she were watching. Way back when, she was saying this in a purely conceptual way, and she was half kidding, but the mental picture helped me. If I found myself alone in a room with a woman colleague, I would wonder, what would Karen think of this if she were watching from a closed-circuit camera? This would gently guide my behavior, and it would prevent me from even approaching behavior she wouldn't like, and of which I wouldn't be proud. It kept me honest. You see what I mean?
I do,
May said. I mean, the trackability of self-driving cars is solving a lot of this, of course. Spouses increasingly know where the other has been, given the car logs where it's been driven. But my point is, what if we all behaved as if we were being watched? It would lead to a more moral way of life. Who would do something unethical or immoral or illegal if they were being watched? If their illegal money transfer was being tracked? If their blackmailing phone call was being recorded? If their stick-up at the gas station was being filmed by a dozen cameras and even their retinas identified during the robbery? If their philandering was being documented in a dozen ways?
I don't know. I'm imagining all that would be greatly reduced.
May? We would finally be compelled to be our best selves, and I think people would be relieved. There would be this phenomenal global sigh of relief. Finally, finally, we can be good. In a world where bad choices are no longer an option, we have no choice but to be good. Can you imagine?
May nodded.
Now, speaking of relief, is there anything you'd like to tell me before we wrap up?
I don't know. So many things, I guess, May said. But you've been so nice to spend all this time with me, so, May, is there something specific that you've kept hidden from me as we've been together here in this library?
May knew, instantly, that lying was not an option.
That I've been here before, she said.
Have you?
Yes.
But you implied when you entered that you hadn't.
Annie brought me, She said it was some kind of secret. I don't know. I didn't know what to do. I didn't see either way as being ideal. I get in trouble either way.
Bailey smiled extravagantly.
See, that's not true. Only lies get us in trouble. Only the things we hide.
Of course I knew you'd been here. Give me some credit.
But I was curious that you hid this from me. It made me feel distant from you. A secret between two friends, May, is an ocean. It's wide and deep, and we lose ourselves in it. And now that I know your secret,
do you feel better or worse?
Better.
Relief?
Yes, relief.
May did feel relief, a surge of it that felt like love. Because she still had her job, and she would not have to go back to Longfield, and because her father would stay strong and her mother unburdened, she wanted to be held by Bailey, to be subsumed by his wisdom and generosity.
May, he said,
I truly believe that if we have no path but the right path, the best path, then that would present a kind of ultimate and all-encompassing relief. We don't have to be tempted by darkness anymore.
Forgive me for putting it in moral terms. That's a Midwestern churchgoer in me. But I'm a believer in the perfectibility of human beings. I think we can be better. I think we can be perfect or near to it. And when we become our best selves, the possibilities are endless. We can solve any problem. We can cure any disease, end hunger, everything, because we won't be dragged down by all our weaknesses, our petty secrets, our hoarding of information and knowledge. We will finally realize our potential.
May had been dizzy from the conversation with Bailey for days, and now it was Friday, and the thought of going on stage at lunch made concentration almost impossible. But she knew she had to work, to set an example for her pod at the very least, given this would likely be her last full day at CE. The flow was steady but not overwhelming, and she got through 77 customer queries that morning. Her score was 98, and the pod aggregate was 97, all respectable numbers. Her party rank was 1,921, another fine figure, and one she felt comfortable taking into the Enlightenment. At 11:38, she left her desk and walked to the side door of the auditorium, arriving 10 minutes before noon. She knocked, and the door opened. May met the stage manager, an older, almost spectral man named Jules, who brought her into a simple dressing room of white walls and bamboo floors. A brisk woman named Teresa, enormous eyes outlined in blue, sat May down, looked over her hair and blushed her face with a feathery brush, and applied a lavalier microphone to her blouse.
"No need to touch anything," she said. "It'll be activated once you go out on stage."
It was happening very quickly, but May felt this was best. If she had more time, she would only get more nervous. So she listened to Jules and Teresa, and in minutes she was in the wings of the stage, listening to 1,000 circlers enter the auditorium, talking and laughing and dropping themselves into their seats with happy thumps. She wondered, briefly, if Calden was anywhere out there.
May?
She turned to find Eamon Bailey behind her, wearing a sky-blue shirt, smiling warmly at her.
Are you ready?
I think so.
You'll be great, he said. Don't worry. Just be natural. We're just recreating the conversation we had last week. Okay?
Okay. And then he was on stage, waving to the crowd, everyone clapping with abandon. There were two burgundy-colored chairs on the stage, facing each other, and Bailey sat down in one and spoke into the darkness.
"Hello, circlers," he said.
"Hello, Eamon,"
they roared back.
"Thank you for being here today on a very special Dream Friday. I thought we'd change it up a bit today and have not a speech, but an interview. As some of you know, we do these from time to time to shed light on members of the circle and their thoughts, their hopes, and in this case, their evolutions."
He sat in one of the chairs and smiled into the wings.
"I had a conversation with a young circler the other day that I wanted to share with you. So I've asked May Holland, who some of you might know as one of our newbies in customer experience, to join me today."
"May?"
May stepped into the light. The feeling was of instant weightlessness, of floating in black space with two distant but bright suns blinding her. She couldn't see anyone in the audience and could barely orient herself to the stage. But she managed to direct her body, her legs made of straw, her feet leaden, toward Bailey. She found her chair and, with two hands,
feeling numb and blind, lowered herself into it.
"Hello, May. How are you?"
"Terrified?" The audience laughed.
"Don't be nervous," Bailey said, smiling to the audience and giving her the slightest look of concern.
"Easy for you to say," she said, and there was laughter throughout the room. This laughter felt good and calmed her. She breathed in and looked in the front row, finding 5 or 6 shadowy faces, all smiling. She was, she realized, and now felt in her bones, among friends. She was safe. She took a sip of water, felt it cool everything inside her, and put her hands in her lap. She felt ready.
"May, in one word, how would you describe the awakening you had this past week?"
This part they had rehearsed. She knew Bailey wanted to start with this idea of an awakening.
"It was just that, Eamon." She'd been instructed to call him Eamon. "It was an awakening."
"Oops, I guess I just stole your thunder," he said. The audience laughed. "I should have said, what did you have this week, but tell us, why that word?"
"Well, awakening seems right to me," May said, and then added, "now."
The word "now" appeared a split second later than it should have, and Bailey's eye twitched.
"Let's talk about this awakening," he said. "It started on Sunday night. Many of the people in the room already know the broad outlines of the events, with sea change and all, but give us a summary."
May looked at her hands in what she realized was a theatrical gesture. She had never before looked at her hands to indicate some level of shame.
"I committed a crime, basically," she said. "I borrowed a kayak without the knowledge of the owner, and I paddled to an island in the middle of the bay."
"That was Blue Island, I understand."
"It was."
"And did you tell anyone you were doing this?"
"No, I didn't."
"Now, May, did you have the intention of telling anyone about this trip afterward?"
"No."
"And did you document it at all? Pictures? Video?"
"No, nothing."
There were some murmurs from the audience. May and Eamon had expected a reaction to this revelation, and they both paused to allow the crowd to assimilate this information.
"Did you know you were doing something wrong in borrowing this kayak without the owner's knowledge?"
"I did."
"But you did it anyway. Why?"
"Because I thought no one would know."
Another low murmur from the audience.
"So this is an interesting point. The very fact that you thought this action would remain secret enabled you to commit this crime, correct?"
"Correct."
"Would you have done it had you known people were watching?"
"Definitely not."
"So, in a way, doing all this in darkness, unobserved and unaccountable, it facilitated impulses that you regret?"
"Absolutely. The fact that I thought I was alone, unwatched, enabled me to commit a crime, and I risked my life. I wasn't wearing a life preserver."
Again, a loud murmur rippled through the audience.
"So, you not only committed a crime against the owner of this property, but you risked your own life, all because you were being enabled by some, what, some cloak of invisibility?"
The audience rumbled with laughter. Bailey's eyes stayed on May, telling her, "Things are going well."
"Right," she said.
"I have a question, May. Do you behave better or worse when you're being watched?"
"Better, without a doubt."
"When you're alone, unwatched, unaccountable, what happens?"
"Well, for one thing, I steal kayaks."
The audience laughed in a sudden bright burst.
"Seriously, I do things I don't want to do. I lie."
"The other day, when we spoke, you had a way of putting it that I thought was very interesting and succinct. Can you tell us all what you said?"
"I said that secrets are lies."
"Secrets are lies. It's very memorable. Can you walk us through your logic with that phrase, May?"
"Well, when there's something kept secret, two things happen. One is that it makes crimes possible. We behave worse when we're not accountable. That goes without saying. And second, secrets inspire speculation. When we don't know what's being hidden, we guess. We make up answers."
"Well, that's interesting, isn't it?"
Bailey turned to the audience.
When we can't reach a loved one, we speculate. We panic. We make up stories about where they are or what's happened to them. And if we're feeling ungenerous or jealous, we make up lies. Sometimes some very damaging lies. We assume they're doing something nefarious, all because we don't know something.
It's like when we see two people whispering, May said. We worry, we feel insecure, we make up terrible things they might be saying. We assume it's about us and that it's catastrophic.
When they're probably asking where the bathroom is.
Bailey got a big laugh and enjoyed it.
Right, May said.
She knew she was approaching a few phrases she needed to get right. She'd said them in Bailey's library, and she just needed to say them again the way she'd first said them.
For example, if there's a locked door, I start to make up all kinds of stories about what might be behind it. I feel like it's some kind of secret, and it leads me to making up lies. But if all the doors are open, physically and metaphorically, there's only the one truth.
Bailey smiled. She'd nailed it.
I like that, May. When the doors are open, there's only one truth. So let's recap that first statement of May's. Can we get that on the screen?
The words, "secrets are lies," appeared on the screen behind May. Seeing the words 4 feet tall gave her a complicated feeling, something between thrill and dread.
Bailey was all smiles, shaking his head, admiring the words.
Okay, we've resolved that had you known that you'd be held accountable for your actions, you wouldn't have committed this crime. Your access to the shadows, in this case illusory shadows, facilitates bad behavior. And when you know you're being watched, you are your better self. Correct?
Correct.
Now, let's talk about the second revelation you made after this episode. You mentioned that you didn't document this trip to Blue Island in any way.
Why not?
Well, first of all, I knew I was doing something illegal.
Sure, but you said that you often kayak in the bay, and you'd never documented these trips. You hadn't joined any circle clubs devoted to kayaking, and you hadn't posted accounts, photos, video, or comments. Have you been doing these kayak trips under the auspices of the CIA?
May and the audience laughed.
No.
Then why these secret trips?
You haven't told anyone about them before or after. You haven't mentioned them anywhere. No accounts exist of any of these excursions. Am I right?
You are right.
May heard loud clucks spread through the auditorium. What did you see on this last trip, May? I understand it was quite beautiful.
It was, Eamon. There was an almost full moon, and the water was very calm, and I felt like I was paddling through liquid silver.
Sounds incredible.
It was.
Animals? Wildlife?
I was followed for a while by a Seoul harbor seal, and he dipped above and below the surface as if he was curious and also urging me on. I'd never been to this island. Very few people have. And once I got to the island, I climbed to the top, and the view from the peak was incredible. I saw the golden lights of the city and the black foothills toward the Pacific, and even saw a shooting star.
A shooting star? Lucky you.
I was very lucky.
But you didn't take a picture?
No.
Not any video?
No.
So there's no record of any of this?
No, not outside my own memory.
There were audible groans from the audience. Bailey turned to the audience, shaking his head, indulging them.
Okay, he said, sounding as if he were bracing himself. Now this is where we get into something personal. As you all know, I have a son, Gunner, who was born with CP, cerebral palsy. Though he's living a very full life, and we're trying, always, to improve his opportunities, he is confined to a wheelchair. He can't walk, he can't run, he can't go kayaking.
So what does he do if he wants to experience something like this?
Well, he watches video. He looks at pictures. Much of his experiences of the world come through the experiences of others. And of course, so many of you circlers have been so generous, providing him with video and photos of your own travels. When he experiences the sea change view of a circler climbing Mount Kenya, he feels like he's climbed Mount Kenya. When he sees firsthand video from an America's Cup crew member, Gunner feels in some way that he sailed in the America's Cup too. These experiences were facilitated by generous humans who have shared what they saw with the world, my son included. And we can only extrapolate how many others there are out there like Gunner. Maybe they're disabled, maybe they're elderly, homebound, maybe 1,000 things. But the point is, that there are millions of people who can't see what you saw, May. Does it feel right to have deprived them of seeing what you saw?
May's throat was dry, and she tried not to show her emotion.
It doesn't. It feels very wrong.
May thought of Bailey's son, Gunner, and thought of her own father.
Do you think they have a right to see things like you saw?
I do.
In this short life, Bailey said, why shouldn't everyone see whatever it is they want to see? Why shouldn't everyone have equal access to the sights of the world, the knowledge of the world, all the experiences available in this world?
May's voice was just above a whisper.
Everyone should. But this experience you had, you kept it to yourself, which is curious because you do share online. You work at the Circle. Your party rank is in the T2K. So why do you think this particular hobby of yours, these extraordinary explorations, why hide these from the world?
I can't quite figure out what I was thinking, to be honest, May said.
The crowd murmured. Bailey nodded.
Okay. We just talked about how we, as humans, hide what we're ashamed of. We do something illegal or unethical, and we hide it from the world because we know it's wrong. But hiding something glorious, a wonderful trip on the water, the moonlight coming down, a shooting star?
It was just selfish, Eamon. It was selfish and nothing more. The same way a child doesn't want to share her favorite toy. I understand that secrecy is part of, well, an aberrant behavior system. It comes from a bad place, not a place of light and generosity. And when you deprive your friends or someone like your son, Gunner, of experiences like I had, you're basically stealing from them. You're depriving them of something they have a right to. Knowledge is a basic human right. Equal access to all possible human experiences is a basic human right.
May surprised herself with her eloquence, and the audience answered with thunderous applause. Bailey was looking at her like a proud father. When the applause subsided, Bailey spoke softly, as if reluctant to get in her way.
You had a way of putting it that I'd like you to repeat.
Well, it's embarrassing, but I said that sharing is caring.
The audience laughed. Bailey smiled warmly.
I don't think it's embarrassing. This expression has been around for a while, but it applies here, doesn't it, May? Maybe uniquely apropos.
I think it's simple. If you care about your fellow human beings, you share what you know with them. You share what you see. You give them anything you can. If you care about their plight, their suffering, their curiosity, their right to learn and know anything the world contains, you share with them. You share what you have and what you see and what you know. To me, the logic there is undeniable.
The audience cheered, and while they did so, three new words, sharing is caring, appeared on the screen, below the previous three. Bailey was shaking his head, amazed.
I love that. May, you have a way with words. And there's one more statement you made that I think should cap off what I think everyone here would agree has been a wonderfully enlightening and inspiring talk.
The audience clapped warmly.
We were talking about what you saw as the impulse to keep things to yourself.
Well, it's not something I'm proud of, and I don't think it rises above the level of simple selfishness. Now, I really understand that. I understand that we're obligated as humans to share what we see and know, and that all knowledge must be democratically accessible.
It's a natural state of information to be free.
Right.
We all have a right to know everything we can. We all collectively own the accumulated knowledge of the world.
Right, May said.
So what happens if I deprive anyone or everyone of something I know? Aren't I stealing from my fellow humans?
Indeed, Bailey said, nodding earnestly.
May looked to the audience and saw the entire first row, the only faces visible, nodding too.
And given your way with words, May, I wonder if you can tell us this third and last revelation you made. What did you say?
Well, I said privacy is theft.
Bailey turned to the audience.
Isn't that an interesting way of putting it, guys? Privacy is theft.
The words now appeared on the screen behind him in great white letters. Privacy is theft. May turned to look at the three lines together. She blinked back tears, seeing it all there. Had she really thought of all that herself? Secrets are lies. Sharing is caring. Privacy is theft. May's throat was tight, dry. She knew she couldn't speak, so she hoped Bailey wouldn't ask her to. As if sensing how she felt, that she was overcome, he winked at her and turned to the audience.
Let's thank May for her candor, her brilliance, and her consummate humanity. Can we, please?
The audience was on its feet. May's face was on fire. She didn't know if she should sit or stand. She stood briefly, then felt silly, so sat down again and waved from her lap. Somewhere, in the stampeding applause, Bailey managed to announce the capper to it all, that May, in the interest of sharing all she saw and could offer the world, would be going transparent immediately. Book 2. It was a bizarre creature, ghost-like, vaguely menacing, and never still. But no one who stood before it could look away. May was hypnotized by it, its slashing form, its fins like blades, its milky skin and wool-gray eyes. It was certainly a shark. It had its distinctive shape, its malevolent stare. But this was a new species, omnivorous and blind. Stenton had brought it back from his trip to the Marianas Trench in the Circle submersible. The shark was not the only discovery. Stenton had retrieved heretofore unknown jellyfishes, seahorses, manta rays, all of them near-translucent, ethereal in their movements, all on display in a series of enormous aquariums he'd had constructed, nearly overnight, to house them. May's tasks were to show her watchers the beasts, to explain when necessary, and to be, through the lens worn around her neck, a window into this new world, and the world, generally, of the Circle. Every morning, May put on a necklace, much like Stuart's, but lighter, smaller, and with the lens worn over her heart. There, it presented the steadiest view and the widest. It saw everything that May saw, and often more. The quality of the raw video was such that viewers could zoom, pan, freeze, and enhance. The audio was carefully engineered to focus on her immediate conversations, to record but make secondary any ambient sound or background voices. In essence, it meant that any room she was in was scannable by anyone watching. They could focus in on any corner and, with some effort, isolate and listen to any other conversation. There was to be a feeding for all of Stenton's discoveries any minute, but the animal she and her watchers were particularly interested in was the shark. She hadn't yet seen it eat, but word was it was insatiable and very quick. Though blind, it found its meals immediately, no matter how big or small, alive or dead, and digested them with alarming speed. 1 minute a herring or squid would be dropped into the tank with it, and moments later the shark would deposit on the aquarium floor all that remained of that animal, a tiny, grainy substance that looked like ash. This act was made more fascinating given the shark's translucent skin, which allowed an unfettered view into its digestive process. She heard a droplet through her earpiece. Feeding moved back to 102, a voice said. It was now 12:51. May looked down the dark hallway to the three other aquariums, each of them slightly smaller than the one before it. The hall was kept entirely unlit to best highlight the electric blue aquariums and the fog-white creatures within.
"Let's move over to the octopus for now," the voice said.
The main audio feed, from additional guidance to May, was provided via a tiny earpiece, and this allowed the AG team to give her occasional directions, to suggest she drop by the machine age, for example, to show her watchers a new solar-powered consumer drone that could travel unlimited distances across continents and seas, provided adequate exposure to the sun. She'd done that visit earlier this day. This was a good portion of her day, the touring of various departments, the introduction of new products, either Circle-made or Circle-endorsed. It ensured that every day was different and had, in the 6 weeks she'd been transparent, exposed May to virtually every corner of the campus, from the Age of Sail to the Old Kingdom, where they were on a lark more than anything, working on a project to attach a camera to every remaining polar bear.
"Let's see the octopus," May said to her viewers.
She moved over to a round glass structure 16 feet high and 12 feet in diameter. Inside, a pale, spineless being, the hue of a cloud but veined in blue and green, was feeling around, guessing and flailing, like a near-blind man fumbling for his glasses.
"This is a relative of the telescope octopus," May said. "But this one has never been captured alive before."
Its shape seemed to change continuously, balloon-like and bulbous one moment, as if inflating itself, confident and growing. Then the next it would be shrinking, spinning, stretching and reaching, unsure of its true form.
"As you can see, its true size is very hard to discern. One second it seems like you could hold it in your hand, and the next it encompasses most of the tank."
The creature's tentacles seemed to want to know everything. The shape of the glass, the topography of the coral below, the feel of the water all around.
"He's almost endearing," May said, watching the octopus reach from wall to wall, spreading itself like a net.
Something about its curiosity gave it a sentient presence, full of doubt and wanting.
"Stanton found this one first,"
she said about the octopus, which was now rising from the floor, slowly, flamboyantly.
"It came from behind his submersible and shot in front as if it were asking him to follow. You can see how fast it might have moved."
The octopus was now careening around the aquarium, propelling itself in motions like the opening and closing of an umbrella. May checked the time. It was 12:54. She had a few minutes to kill. She kept her lens on the octopus. She was under no illusion that every minute of every day was equally scintillating to her watchers. In the 3 weeks May had been transparent, there had been downtime, a good deal of it, but her task, primarily, was to provide an open window into life at the circle, the sublime and the banal.
"Here we are in the gym,"
she might say, showing viewers the health club for the first time.
"People are running and sweating and devising ways to check each other out without getting caught."
Then, an hour later, she might be eating lunch, casually and without commentary, across from other circlers, all of them behaving, or attempting to, as if no one was watching at all. Most of her fellow circlers were happy to be on camera, and after a few days, all circlers knew that it was part of their job at the circle, and an elemental part of the circle, period. If they were to be a company espousing transparency and the global and unending advantages of open access, they needed to be living that ideal, always and everywhere, and especially on campus. Thankfully, there was enough to illuminate and celebrate within the circle gates. The fall and winter had brought the inevitable, all of it, with blitzkrieg speed. All over campus, there were signs that hinted at imminent completion. The messages were cryptic, meant to pique curiosity and discussion. What would completion mean? Staffers were asked to contemplate this, submit answers, and write on the idea boards. "Everyone on Earth has a circle account," one popular message said.
"The circle solves world hunger," said another.
"The circle helps me find my ancestors," said yet another.
"No data, human or numerical or emotional or historical, is ever lost again."
That one had been written and signed by Bailey himself. The most popular was, "The circle helps me find myself." So many of these developments had been long in the planning stages at the circle, but the timing had never been quite so right, and the momentum was too strong to be resisted. Now, with 90% of Washington transparent and the remaining 10% wilting under the suspicion of their colleagues and constituents, the question beat down on them like an angry sun. What are you hiding? The plan was that most circlers would be transparent within the year, but for the time being, to work out the bugs and get everyone used to the idea, it was just May and Stewart. But his experiment had been largely eclipsed by May's. May was young and moved far quicker than Stewart and had her voice. Watchers loved it, comparing it to music, calling it like woodwind and a wonderful acoustic strum. And May was loving it too, feeling daily the affection of millions flow through her. It took getting used to, though, starting with the basic working of the equipment. The camera was light, and after a few days, May could barely sense the weight of the lens, no heavier than a locket over her breastbone. They'd tried various ways to keep it on her chest, including Velcro attached to her clothing, but nothing was as effective and simple as simply hanging it around her neck. The second adjustment, one she found continually fascinating and occasionally jarring, was seeing, through a small frame on her right wrist, what the camera was seeing. She'd all but forgotten about her left wrist health monitor, but the camera had made essential the use of this, a second right wrist bracelet. It was the same size and material as her left, but with a larger screen to accommodate video and a summation of all her data on her usual screens. With a bracelet on each wrist, each snug and with a brushed metal finish, she felt like Wonder Woman and knew something of her power, though the idea was too ridiculous to tell anyone about. On her left wrist, she saw her heartbeat. On her right, she could see what her watchers were seeing, a real-time view from her lens, which allowed her to make any necessary adjustments to the view. It also gave her current watcher numbers, her rankings and ratings, and highlighted the most recent and most popular comments from viewers. At that moment, standing before the octopus, May had 441,762 watchers, which was a little above her average, but still less than what she'd hoped for while revealing Stenton's deep-sea discoveries. The other numbers displayed were unsurprising. She was averaging 845,029 unique visitors to her live footage in any given day, and had 2.1 million followers to her Zing feed. She no longer had to worry about staying in the T2K. Her visibility and the immense power of her audience guaranteed stratospheric conversion rates and retail ROAS, and ensured she was always in the top 10.
"Let's see the seahorses," May said, and moved to the next aquarium. There, amid a pastel bouquet of coral and flowing fronds of blue seaweed, she saw hundreds, maybe thousands, of tiny beings, no bigger than the fingers of a child, hiding in nooks, clinging to the foliage.
"Not particularly friendly fish, these guys. Wait, are they even fish?" she asked, and looked to her wrist, where a watcher had already sent the answer.
"Absolutely a fish. Class Actinopterygii, same as cod and tuna."
"Thank you, Susanna Wynn from Greensboro," May said, and re-zinged the information to her followers. "Now let's see if we can find the daddy of all these baby seahorses. As you might know, the male seahorse is the one that carries the offspring. The hundreds of babies you see were birthed just after the daddy arrived here. Now where is he?"
May walked around the aquarium and soon found him, about the size of her hand, resting at the bottom of the tank, leaning against the glass.
"I think he's hiding," May said. "But he doesn't seem to know we're on the other side of the glass here and can see everything."
She checked her wrist and adjusted the angle of her lens a bit to get the best look at the fragile fish. He was curled with his back to her, looking exhausted and shy. She put her face and lens up to the glass, so close to him she could see the tiny clouds in his intelligent eyes, the unlikely freckles on his delicate snout. He was an improbable creature, a terrible swimmer, built like a Chinese lantern and utterly without defense. Her wrist highlighted a zing with exceptionally high ratings. "The croissant of the animal kingdom," it said. And May repeated it aloud. But despite his fragility, somehow he had already reproduced, had given life to 100 more like himself, while the octopus and the shark had traced the contours of their tanks and eaten. Not that the seahorse seemed to care. He was apart from his progeny, as if having no clue where they came from and no interest in what happened to them. May checked the time. 1:02. Additional guidance spoke through her earpiece. "Shark feeding ready?"
"Okay," May said, glancing at her wrist. "I'm seeing a bunch of requests that we get back to the shark, and it's after 1, so I'm thinking we'll do that."
She left the seahorse, who turned to her briefly, as if not wanting to see her go. May made her way back to the first and largest aquarium, which held Stenton's shark. Above the aquarium, she saw a young woman with curly black hair and cuffed white jeans standing atop a sleek red ladder.
"Hello,"
May said to her.
"I'm May."
The woman seemed ready to say, "I know that," but then, as if remembering they were on camera, adopted a studied, performative tone.
"Hello, May. I'm Georgia, and I'll be feeding Mr. Stenton's shark now."
And then, though it was blind, and there was no food yet in the tank, the shark seemed to sense a feast was at hand. It began turning like a cyclone, rising ever closer to the surface. May's watchers had already risen by 42,000.
"Someone's hungry," May said.
The shark, which had seemed only passingly menacing before, now appeared vicious and wholly sentient, the embodiment of the predatory instinct. Georgia was attempting to look confident, competent, but May saw fear and trepidation in her eyes.
"Ready down there?"
she asked, without taking her eyes off the shark making its way toward her.
"We're ready," May said.
"Okay. I'm going to feed the shark something new today. As you know, he's been fed all kinds of stuff, from salmon to herring to jellyfish. He's devoured everything with equal enthusiasm. Yesterday we tried a manta, which we didn't expect him to enjoy, but he didn't hesitate and ate with gusto. So today we're again experimenting with a new food. As you can see," she said, and May noticed that the bucket she carried was made of lucite, and inside she saw something blue and brown with too many legs. She heard it ticking against the bucket walls. A lobster. May had never thought of sharks eating lobsters, but she couldn't see why they wouldn't.
"Here we have a regular Maine lobster, which we're not sure if this shark is equipped to eat."
Georgia was perhaps trying to put on a good show, but even May was nervous about how long she was holding the lobster over the water. "Drop it," May thought to herself. "Please drop it." But Georgia was holding it over the water, presumably for the benefit of May and her viewers. The shark, meanwhile, had sensed the lobster, had no doubt mapped its shape with whatever sensors it possessed, and was circling quicker, still obedient, but at the end of its patience.
"Some sharks can process the shells of crustaceans like this. Some can't," Georgia said, now dangling the lobster such that its claw was lazily touching the surface.
"Drop it, please," May thought. "Please drop it now."
"So I'll just drop this little guy into—"
But before she could finish her sentence, the shark had risen up and snatched the lobster from the caretaker's hand. By the time Georgia let out a squeal and grabbed her fingers, as if to count them, the shark was already back in the middle of the tank, the lobster engulfed in its jaws, the crustacean's white flesh spraying from the shark's wide mouth.
"Did he get you?"
May asked. Georgia shook her head, holding back tears.
"Almost."
She rubbed her hand, as if it had been burned. The lobster had been consumed, and May saw something gruesome and wonderful. The lobster was being processed, inside the shark, in front of her, with lightning speed and incredible clarity. May saw the lobster broken into dozens, then hundreds of pieces, in the shark's mouth, then saw those pieces make their way through the shark's gullet, its stomach, its intestines. In minutes, the lobster had been reduced to a grainy, particulate substance. The waste left the shark and fell like snow to the aquarium floor.
"Looks like he's still hungry,"
Georgia said. She was atop the ladder again, but now with a different lucite container. While May had been watching the digestion of the lobster, Georgia had retrieved a second meal.
"Is that what I think it is?"
May asked.
"This is a Pacific sea turtle,"
Georgia said, holding up the container that held the reptile. It was about as big as Georgia's torso, painted in a patchwork of green and blue and brown, a beautiful animal, unable to move in the tight space. Georgia opened the door at one end of the container, as if inviting the turtle to exit if he so chose. He chose to stay where he was.
"There's little chance our shark has encountered one of these, given the difference in their habitats,"
Georgia said.
"This turtle would have no reason to spend time where Stenton's shark dwells, and the shark surely has never seen the light-dappled areas where the turtles live."
May wanted to ask if Georgia were truly about to feed that turtle to the shark. Its eyes had beheld the predator below and was now, with the slow energy it could harness, pushing its way to the back of the container. Feeding this kindly creature to the shark, no matter the necessity or scientific benefit, would not please many of May's watchers. Already zings were coming through her wrist.
"Please don't kill that turtle. It looks like my granddad."
There was a second thread, though, that insisted the shark, which was not much bigger than the turtle, would not be able to swallow or digest the reptile with its impenetrable shell. But just when May was about to question the imminent feeding, an AG voice came through May's earpiece.
Hold tight. Stanton wants to see this happen.
In the tank, the shark was circling again, looking every bit as lean and ravenous as before. The lobster had been nothing to it, a meaningless snack. Now it rose closer to Georgia, knowing the main course was approaching.
"Here we go,"
Georgia said, and tilted the container until the turtle began sliding, slowly, toward the neon water which was swirling beneath him. The shark's turning had created a vortex. When the container was vertical and the turtle's head had cleared the lucite threshold, the shark could wait no longer. It rose up, grabbed the turtle's head in its jaws, and pulled it under. And like the lobster, the turtle was consumed in seconds, but this time it took a shape-shifting that the crustacean hadn't required. The shark seemed to unhook its jaw, doubling the size of its mouth, enabling it to easily subsume the whole of the turtle in one swallow. Georgia was narrating, saying something about how many sharks, when eating turtles, will turn their stomachs inside out, vomiting the shells after digesting the fleshy parts of the reptile. But Stenton's shark had other methods. The shell seemed to dissolve inside the shark's mouth and stomach like a cracker soaked in saliva, and in less than a minute, the turtle, all of it, had been turned to ash. It exited the shark, as had the lobster, in flakes that fell ponderously to the aquarium floor, joining and indistinguishable from those that had come before. May was watching this when she saw a figure, nearly a silhouette, on the other side of the glass, beyond the aquarium's far wall. His body was just a shadow, his face invisible. But then, for a moment, the light from above reflected on the circling shark's skin and revealed the figure's face. It was Cowden. May hadn't seen him in a month, and since her transparency, hadn't heard any word from him. Annie had been in Amsterdam, then China, then Japan, then back to Geneva, and so hadn't had time to focus on Cowden. But the two of them had traded occasional messages about him. How concerned should they be about this unknown man? But then he disappeared. Now he was standing, looking at her, unmoving. She wanted to call out, but then worried. Who was he? Would calling to him, capturing him on camera, create some scene? Would he flee? She was still in shock from the shark's digestion of the turtle, from its dull-eyed wrath, and she found she had no voice, no strength to say Cowden's name. So she stared at him, and he stared at her, and she had the thought that if she could catch him on her camera, perhaps she could show this to Annie, and that might lead to some clarity, some identification. But when May looked to her wrist, she saw only the darkest form, his face obscured. Perhaps her lens couldn't see him, was watching from a different angle. As she tracked his shape on her wrist, he backed away and walked off into the shadows. Meanwhile, Georgia had been nattering about the shark and what they'd witnessed, and May hadn't caught any of it. But now she was standing atop her ladder, waving, hoping that May was finished, because she had nothing left to feed the animal. The show was over.
"Okay, then,"
May said, thankful for the chance to get away and to follow Cowden. She said goodbye and thanks to Georgia and walked briskly through the dark hallway. She caught sight of his silhouette leaving through a faraway door, and she picked up her pace, careful not to shake her lens or call out. The door he'd slipped through led to the newsroom, which would be a logical enough place for May to be visiting next.
"Let's see what's going on in the newsroom,"
she said, knowing all within would be aware of her approach and the 20 steps it would take her to get there. She also knew that the sea-change cameras in the hallway, over the doorway, would have caught Cowden, and she'd know sooner or later if it was actually him. Every movement within the circle was caught on one camera or another, usually three, and reconstructing anyone's movements, after the fact, was only a few minutes' work. As she approached the newsroom door, May thought of Cowden's hands upon her, his hands reaching low, pulling himself into her. She heard the low rumble of his voice, his taste like some wet, fresh fruit. What if she found him? She couldn't take him to the bathroom, or could she? She would find a way. She opened the door to the newsroom, a wide space Bailey had modeled on old-time newspaper offices, with 100 low cubicles, news tickers, and clocks everywhere, each desk with a retro analog telephone, a row of white buttons below the numbers, blinking arrhythmically. There were old printers, fax machines, telex devices, letter presses. The decor, of course, was for show. All the retro machines were non-functional. The news gatherers, whose faces were now upon May, smiling, saying hello to her and her watchers, were able to do most of their reporting via sea change. There were now over 100 million cameras functional and accessible around the world, making in-person reporting unnecessarily expensive and dangerous, to say nothing of the carbon expenditures. As May walked through the newsroom, the staff waved to her, unsure if this was an official visit. May waved back, scanning the room, knowing she appeared distracted. Where was Calden? There was only one other exit, so May rushed to the room, nodding and greeting until she came to the door on the far end. She opened it, flinching at the bright light of day, and saw him. He was crossing the wide green lawn, passing the new sculpture by that Chinese dissident. She remembered she should highlight it soon, maybe even today. And just then he turned briefly, as if checking to see if May was still following. Her eyes met his, provoking a tiny smile, before he turned again and walked quickly around the period of 5 dynasties. "Where are you headed?" the voice in her ear asked. "Sorry, no place. I was just... never mind."
May was allowed, of course, to go where she pleased. Her meanderings were what so many watchers appreciated most, but the additional guidance office still liked to check in from time to time. As she stood in the sunlight, circlers all around, she heard her phone ring. She checked her wrist. There was no caller identified. She knew it could only be Calden.
"Hello?" she said.
"We have to meet," he said.
"Excuse me?" she asked.
"Your watchers can't hear me. They only hear you. Right now, your engineers are wondering why the incoming audio isn't working. They'll fix it in a few minutes." His voice was tense, shaky. "So listen, most of what's happening must stop. I'm serious. The circle is almost complete. In May, you have to believe me that this will be bad for you, for me, for humanity. When can we meet? If it has to be in the bathroom, that's fine with me."
May hung up.
"Sorry about that," said A.G. through her earpiece. "Somehow the incoming audio wasn't working. We're working on it. Who was it?" May knew she couldn't lie. She wasn't sure if anyone had indeed heard Calden.
"Some lunatic," May improvised, proud of herself. "Babbling about the end of the world." May checked her wrist. Already people were wondering what had happened and how. The most popular zing, "Tech problems at Circle HQ? Next, Santa forgets Christmas?"
"Tell them the truth, as always," A.G. said.
"Okay, I have no idea what just happened," May said aloud. "When I do, I'll let you all know."
But she was shaken. She was still standing, in the sunlight, waving occasionally to circlers noticing her. She knew her watchers might wonder what was happening next, where she was going. She didn't want to check her wrist, knowing that the comments would be perplexed and even concerned. Off in the distance, she saw what looked like a game of croquet, and, alighting on an idea, she made her way to it.
"Now, as you all know," she said when she was close enough to see and wave to the 4 players, who she realized were 2 circlers and a pair of visitors from Russia, "we do not always play here at the circle. Sometimes we have to work, which this group is demonstrating. I don't want to disturb them, but I can assure you that what they're doing involves problem-solving and complex algorithms and will result in the improving of the products and services we can provide to you. Let's soak this in."
That would give her a few minutes to think. Periodically, she would focus her lens on something like this, a game or demonstration or speech, and this might allow her mind to wander while the watchers watched. She checked the view on her wrist and saw that her watchers, 432,028, were within the average, and there were no urgent comments, so she permitted herself 3 minutes before she had to retake control of the feed. With a wide smile, for she was surely visible on 3 or 4 outdoor sea changes, she took a breath. This was a new skill she'd acquired, the ability to look to the outside world utterly serene and even cheerful, while, in her skull, all was chaos. She wanted to call Annie, but she couldn't call Annie. She wanted Calden. She wanted to be alone with Calden. She wanted to be back in that bathroom, sitting on him, feeling the crown of him pushed through. But he was not normal. He was some kind of spy here, some kind of anarchist, doomsayer. What had he meant when he warned of the completion of the circle?
She didn't even know what completion meant. No one did. The wise men had recently begun to hint about it, though. One day, in new tiles all over campus, cryptic messages had appeared. Think completion, and complete the circle, and the circle must be whole. And these slogans had stirred up the desired intrigue, but no one knew what it meant, and the wise men weren't telling. May checked the time. She'd been watching the croquet match for 90 seconds. She could only reasonably hold this pose for another minute or two. So what was her responsibility to report this call? Had anyone actually heard what Calden had said? What if they had? What if this was some kind of test to see if she'd report a rogue call? Maybe this was part of completion, a test like this to measure her loyalty, to thwart anyone or anything that would impede completion. Oh, shit, she thought. She wanted to talk to Annie, but she knew she couldn't. She thought of her parents, who would give good counsel, but their house was transparent, too, full of sea-change cameras, a condition of her father's treatment. Maybe she could go there, meet them in the bathroom. No. She hadn't actually been in touch with them for a few days. They had warned her they were having some technical difficulties, would be back in touch soon, that they loved her, and then hadn't answered any of her messages for the last 48 hours. And in that time, she hadn't checked the cameras in their house. She had to do that. She made a mental note. Maybe she could call them, make sure they were okay, and then hint, somehow, that she wanted to talk to them about something very unsettling and personal? No, this was all mad. She'd gotten a random call from a man she now knew to be nuts. Oh, shit, she thought, hoping no one could guess at the chaos in her mind. She relished being where she was, visible like this, a conduit like this, a guide to her watchers, but this responsibility, this unnecessary intrigue, it crippled her. And when she felt this paralysis, caught between entirely too many possibilities and unknowns, there was only one place she felt right. At 1:44, May entered the Renaissance, felt above her the greeting of the slowly turning Calder, and took the elevator to the 4th floor. Just rising through the building calmed her. Walking down the catwalk, the atrium visible below, brought her great peace. This customer experience was home, where there were no unknowns. At first, May had been surprised when they'd asked her to continue working at least a few hours a week at CE. She'd enjoyed her time there, yes, but she assumed transparency would mean she'd leave that far behind. "That's exactly the point," Bailey had explained. "I think, number one, it'll keep you connected with the ground-level work you did here. Number two, I think your followers and viewers will appreciate you continuing to do this essential work. It'll be a very moving act of humility, don't you think?" May was at once aware of the power she wielded. Instantly, she became one of the 3 most visible circlers, and determined to wear it lightly. So May had found time in each week to return to her old pod and to her old desk, which they'd left vacant. There had been changes made. There were now 9 screens, and the CEs were encouraged to be delving far deeper with their clients, to reciprocate in far-reaching ways. But the work was essentially the same, and May found that she appreciated the rhythm of it, the almost meditative quality of doing something she knew in her bones, and she found herself being drawn to CE at times of stress or calamity. And so, in her 3rd week of transparency, on a sunny Wednesday, she planned on putting in 90 minutes at CE before the rest of the day overtook her. At 3, she had to give a tour of the Napoleonic era, where they were modeling the elimination of physical money. The trackability of internet currency would eliminate huge swaths of crime overnight. And at 4, she was supposed to highlight the new musicians' residences on campus, 22 fully equipped apartments where musicians, especially those who couldn't count on making a living through sales of their music, could live for free and play regularly for the circlers. That would take her through the afternoon. At 5, she was supposed to attend an announcement from the latest politician to go clear. Why they continued to make these proclamations with fanfare, they were now calling them clarifications, was a mystery to her and many of her watchers. There were tens of thousands of clear elected officials all over the country and world, and the movement was less a novelty and more of an inevitability. Most observers predicted full governmental transparency, at least in democracies, and with sea change there would soon be no other kind, within 18 months. After the clarification, there was an improv comedy battle on campus, a fundraiser for a school in rural Pakistan, a wine tasting, and finally, an all-campus barbecue, with music by a Peruvian trance choir.
May walked into her old pod room, where her own words, "Secrets are lies, sharing is caring, privacy is theft," had been cast in steel and dominated an entire wall. The place was bursting with newbies, all of whom looked up, alarmed and happy to see her there among them. She waved to them, gave them a theatrical faux curtsy, saw Jared standing in the doorway to his office, and waved at him too. Then, determined to do her work without fanfare, May sat down, logged on, and opened the chute. She answered 3 queries in rapid succession, with an average of 99. Her 4th client was the first to notice that it was May, transparent May, handling her query.
"I'm watching you,"
the client, a media buyer for a sporting goods importer in New Jersey, wrote. Her name was Janice, and she couldn't get over the fact she could watch May typing the answer to her query in real time on her screen right next to where she was receiving May's typed answer. "Hall of Mirrors," she wrote. After Janice, May had a series of clients who did not know it was her answering their queries, and May found that this bothered her. One of them, a T-shirt distributor from Orlando named Nancy, asked her to join her professional network, and May readily agreed. Jared had told her about a new level of reciprocation encouraged among the CE staff. If you send a survey, be prepared to answer one yourself. And so, after she joined the Orlando T-shirt distributor's professional network, she got another message from Nancy. She asked May to respond to a short questionnaire about her preferences in casual apparel, and May agreed. She linked to the questionnaire, which she realized was not short. It encompassed fully 120 questions, but May was happy to answer them, feeling her opinion mattered and was being heard, and this kind of reciprocation would engender loyalty from Nancy and all who Nancy came into contact with. After she answered the survey questions, Nancy sent her a profuse thank you and told her she could choose the T-shirt of her choice, and directed May to her consumer site. May said she would choose at a later time, but Nancy wrote back, telling May that she could not wait to see which shirt May would choose. May checked her clock. She'd been on the Orlando query for 8 minutes, far surpassing the new guideline per query, which was 2.5. May knew she would have to power through the next 10 or so queries to get back to an acceptable average. She went to Nancy's site, chose a shirt that featured a cartoon dog in a superhero costume, and Nancy told her that it was a great choice. May then took the next query and was in the process of an easy boilerplate conversion when another message came from Nancy.
"Sorry to be missensitive, but after I invited you to choose my professional network, you didn't ask me to join your professional network. And though I know I'm just a nobody in Orlando, I felt like I had to tell you that it made me feel devalued."
May told Nancy she had no intentions of making her feel devalued, that things were just busy at the circle, and that she had spaced on this essential reciprocation, which she quickly remedied. May finished her next query, got a 98, and was following up on that one when she got another message from Nancy.
"Did you see my message on the professional network?"
May looked at all her feeds and saw no message from Nancy.
"I posted it on the message board of your professional network," she said.
And so May went to that page, which she didn't visit often, and saw that Nancy had written, "Hello, stranger." May typed, "Hello yourself, but you're no stranger," and thought for a moment that that would mean the end of their exchange. But she paused on the page, briefly, with a sense that Nancy was not quite finished. And she wasn't.
"So glad you wrote back. Thought you might be offended that I called you stranger. Promise you weren't peeved?"
May promised Nancy that she was not peeved. Answered with an XO, sent her 10